BBC in Naples,
Tel Aviv,
Perth,
Accra.
Wherever you are, you're with the BBC.
You're listening to KPFT, Houston 90.1 FM.
Rogelio Kennedy is a prisoner in Texas. By the end of the show, he will be dead. This is Execution Watch. Texas has given up public hangings, but witness with us the legal homicide by lethal injection of Rogelio Kennedy in Huntsville, Texas, death penalty capital of the Western world. Execution Watch host, Ray Hill. Legal analyst, Jim Skelton. Huntsville reporter outside the death house, Dennis Longmire. Vigil reporter in Brownsville, Joe Krause. And special guest, Chris Castillo, National Texas Outreach Coordinator of Murder Victims' Families for Reconciliation. The Execution Watch begins.
Don't you know they're killing people? 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 Don't you know they're killing people?
And this is Ray Hill. I am coming to you via KPFT Houston HD2 channel by executionwatch.org, which you can reach either through theprisonshow.org or kpft.org. May the 19th, a Wednesday, and on this day, Rogelio Kennedy has been scheduled for execution in Huntsville. Tonight's show will have our legal analyst, Jim Skelton, an interview with Chris Castillo, who is with Murder Victims Families for Reconciliation. We'll receive reports from Huntsville from Professor Dennis Longmire of Sam Houston State University Criminal Justice School. We'll get a report from a vigil in Brownsville where Joe Krause is one of the organizers and vigilants down there. This program is produced by Elizabeth Stein, and we could not survive without the electronic wizardry of Otis McClay. The music is by Victoria Panetti, and all of that information later. What is happening now is Elizabeth is off in the other room trying to connect with Dennis Longmire outside the death house in Huntsville. If things are proceeding as scheduled and the United States denied any relief only an hour and a half ago, and so we were hoping maybe for clemency, but that virtually never happens in Texas. Dennis, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
And where are you?
Well, I am on the corner where the vigil always occurs. Both sets of witnesses have already entered the major prison, which means that the execution is going forward, and they are not going to slow down for a second.
Okay. Dennis, are there many vigilants there?
There are five of us who are very regular vigilants, and we are here prayerfully protesting and standing in the face of death as we stand here.
Okay, five is fewer than we've had the last couple of times.
And it doesn't surprise me. This particular case, there's not a lot of notoriety or a lot of attention that has been given to it, and so it originates way far away from here, so it's very likely that the crowd is a product of that.
Well, actually, this is a case of men being executed for a murder that happened inside prison.
Correct.
And that is new litigation, and so it's going to give Jim and I something to talk about. But there's no sign of family out there either for the perp or the victim, right?
No family members for either side are present to us on the corner. We believe that perhaps Mr. Kennedy's sister is among the witnesses. One of the guys here who's a vigilant has visited with men on death row, and he had the opportunity to get to meet Mr. Kennedy's sister, and he thinks perhaps she was one of the witnesses that went in on his behalf. It looked to me like there were five, maybe six people who went in to witness for Mr. Kennedy. Again, we do not have any contact or any way to visually identify anyone who might be witnessing for the victim, since they will already have been in the prison before we get here.
That is Professor Dennis Longmire of University, Sam Houston University Criminal Justice School. Dennis, you will let us know if any further action happens.
I will do that.
Thank you, sir.
Sure thing.
And that is Dennis Longmire of Sam Houston University. And now we're back in the studio. And this is a little bit different case, isn't it, Jim?
Sure is, you mean. Yep.
We can't say that this is less a bad dude than other bad dudes that we've dealt with, but that this is probably the first execution for a murder that occurred inside prison.
It is the first one.
It is the first one. Well, kind of what happens when legislation passes.
What do you mean by it?
Well, obviously the state legislature had to come up with a...
Well, what they did, to understand this, you have to understand what we call a 3G offense. And what happened, the legislature has labeled certain offenses being 3G. Among those are murder, mm-hmm. capital murder, mm-hmm. indecency with the child. Indecency with the child means that you fondle the child, but there's no penetration. That's what indecency means. Aggravated kidnapping, aggravated sexual assault, and aggravated robbery. Those were considered 3G offenses. And what this law said that took effect September the 1st, 1993, if you're serving a 99-year sentence or a life sentence for a 3G offense, in other mm-hmm. words, if you're serving a life sentence or 99-year sentence for those listed crimes I just mentioned, and you commit a murder while serving that term, they can seek the death penalty. And that's why this is unique about this case, because this is the first case that came, that happened after this law took effect.
And this is 1993 legislature that passed this law.
Well, what happened, we've had 3G offenses for a long time.
Yeah.
But murder and indecency with a child were not added until September the 1st, 1993.
Okay.
So it became effective then. And what the argument made in this case was initially, is that he was in jail. Kennedy, this guy, Helio Kennedy, had a long history. He'd been in trouble since he's been 10 years old, one of those typical patterns you see mm-hmm. where you got in a lot of trouble as a juvenile, anywhere from using drugs to stealing to theft and all the truancy and the various things that kids get in trouble for. He was on bond for an aggravated robbery case out of Harlingen. And while he was on bond, he and some companions apparently kidnapped a couple of kids, a 15-year-old boy and a 13-year-old girl, that were runaways and were living in an orphanage in Brownsville. And he kills the boy. At least he's one of the three that killed his, and his companions kill the boy. They then decide to kill the 13-year-old girl. And Kennedy is accused of sexually assaulting her, then taking her to a shower, cleaning her up, sexually assaulting her a second time, then taking her out after he sexually assaults her a second time. And while one of his companions holds her down, he strangles her to death with a handkerchief.
Mm-hmm.
So he committed two murders in Cameron County. In a little town called Laferia, they found the bodies in one of those irrigation canals in Laferia. And he was initially charged with capital murder on those two crimes. And they worked out a plea agreement where he reduced the charges to straight murder, and he got two consecutive life sentences. So what happened, he committed the murders in 1990. When he committed the murders, murder then was not a 3G offense. Mm-hmm. It was only 3 years later that it was added, because it was added and became effective September the 1st, 1993. So when he committed the murders, they were not 3G offenses. After he committed this murder and that he got tried for, it was a 3G offense.
Well, this happened in 1993.
Right.
He didn't mess around. He didn't waste any time.
No, he's a killing machine.
Yeah.
And what happened in this particular murder, after he got sent to prison, it seems kind of crazy. He was in one of his cellmates was a 55-year-old man from Tarrant County who was also in prison for murder. And so what happened, the guards discover a man in the cell unconscious, almost beat to death, with blood everywhere. And what they pieced together was this. The Rogelio Kennedy got a combination lock and put it in a sock. and knocked this 55-year-old cellmate of his in the head, subdued him, tied him up, and then beat him to death and kicked him to death and stomped him to death with steel-toed boots. He was alive when the guards found him, but he later died in Corpus Christi. So what you have is a man in jail serving two life sentences for murder that kills his roommate, who's also in jail for murder. And this was the first time anybody had been tried under this new law, and the big argument he made on appeal was that when I committed the murders in 1990, this was not a 3G offense. And yet, after I committed the murders, they then changed it to a 3G offense, and there's a thing in law called ex post facto legislation. And what that basically means is this: a legislature cannot increase punishment for conduct that's already been committed. In other words, if you commit an act, they can't later make that criminal, they can't later increase the penalty. And that was his argument. His argument was to make the murder of the cellmate a capital murder. They had to prove up two other murders, and they had to prove those are 3G offenses. And his argument on appeal was, in fact, he made the argument at the trial level, that the initial murders, the two kiddos, the two runaways, since they were not 3G offenses when he committed them, it was an element of the state's case, it was ex post facto to execute him to seek capital murder on this later charge. And the judge agreed initially and dismissed the capital murder charges. The state appealed that, and the Corpus Christi Court of Appeals reversed the case, and they said, though, and what they always say in cases like this, is that this legislation did not increase the punishment for the initial crime, because the initial crimes were murder. The initial crimes back then were 5 to life. It didn't increase that punishment range. All it did was change the category, how they would treat that crime if he committed another offense. So it's not ex post facto because it didn't increase the punishment. It just simply, what it did, it simply changed how that offense would be used at a later date. And they say that's not ex post facto.
I'm not a little loose and fast with the principle.
Of course it's loose and fast, but what happens oftentimes when they want to execute somebody and uphold a statute, they're going to be loose and fast about it. And they're really, when it comes to procedural changes, they said this consistently, that a procedural change usually is not ex post facto because, it did not increase the punishment for the murders committed in 1990.
Crime.
All it did was change how they could be used later to enhance another murder case to a capital murder case.
Well,
that's not increasing punishment.
Normally, when the legislature passes something, it becomes effective on September the 1st.
Sometimes it comes, 90% of the times, it's September the 1st after the legislature ends their.
Any idea about when this crime happened and in relationship to that date?
This crime occurred, this particular offense occurred in October of 1993.
Okay.
So it occurred, the murder of his cellmate occurred.
There would be no ex post facto
in
that. Yeah.
Because it occurred in October of 1993, about a month after the law became effective.
You know, I will never know what happened in that cell because we weren't there. All we have is the blood to clean up and the body to carry out. But here's what can happen, and I'm not saying this did happen. If these two inmates were not getting along well, or if the victim in this cell block crime was, for some reason or other, an irritant to the officers in that wing, they may have put him in there with Kennedy to get killed. There may be accomplices in this crime that we'll never know about, that there's no way to, at this point in time, go explore that and test cases. But, for instance, this last weekend I was visiting on a prison. And not because of anything to do with me, but because of the person I was visiting has become kind of a nuisance on the prison. They tore my artificial leg up, literally tore it up. I have to replace parts of it just to get into a women's prison to visit an inmate. And they're not mad at me. They're not trying to hurt my leg. They're trying to get even with her because she's German. She speaks a little funny. She doesn't fit in. She's often confused about prison life. It's the guards frequently that set up people to become victims of crime inside prison. They know what sets Kennedy off, and so they put poor unwitting Mr. Bonal in there with him and said, let's see what happens now.
Well, that was an issue never raised at trial. What he raised at trial, he claimed he murdered in self-defense. He claimed Bonal tried to sexually assault him or rape him. And that was his defense at trial.
Well, not after he was tied up, I presume.
Well, I'm just simply saying that he just simply said that's what he did, that the guy tried to sexually assault him and he was defending himself. And like I say, he put that lock inside of a sock and pretty well subdued him, beat him up with that. And what they found was the front part of the combination lock. He apparently flushed the lock down the commode. And then they found all the blood and everywhere. That's where they surmised he beat him to death with the lock.
So there was tangible evidence to back up the charge.
And he claimed self-defense because he claimed he was being sexually assaulted. That's what he claimed. Because he never made any accusation, at least during the trial or during the writ process, that anybody set it up. Of course, he may not know that they set it up. They may have done that behind his back. Because I know a friend of mine, Roger Moss.
From his criminal past, I would not estimate him to being the brightest porch light on the block.
Probably not. Yeah. And as a matter of fact, I was talking to a real good friend of mine, Roger Moss. This is really a unique case up in East Texas. In Beaumont, they appointed a lawyer on a 1983 civil rights action that an inmate brought against the prison. And he got beat up for 19 packages of Butler tobacco is all it took for the guards to have him beat up. And the guards were the one that set this up. Because what happened in this particular case in Beaumont, the guards thought this inmate had snitched them off to the warden, and they gave a contract to a prison gang for 19 packages of tobacco to beat him up. They contracted that job out to somebody else, and believe it or not, a Beaumont jury, well, initially the inmate was representing himself. Mm-hmm. And they wouldn't appoint him a lawyer on a civil case. And the Fifth Circuit reversed it with very strong language. You better get him a lawyer. And they appointed my friend Roger. And believe it or not, the jury ruled in favor of the inmate in Beaumont on the 1983 action.
That's kind of rare.
That is extremely rare.
State court?
No, it's federal court.
Federal court.
Because the 1983 is that civil rights action in federal court in the Fifth Circuit.
I know that. I use that. That comes in handy for calling police officers' names and other things.
But the problem is with most of those 1983 actions, when that is set up, they have that immunity that they're so fond of, and usually you're always poured out at a summary judgment level. Because, you know, the person that they usually, the plaintiff, always has a lot of baggage they're carrying with them because they're prisoners. And that's the problem you always have with those 1983 actions.
Well, can you tell from the record of the case that whether or not Mr. Kennedy was adequately represented?
I read the direct appeal, Ray, and they did an extremely thorough job in the direct appeal. There never was any sort of hint. What they tried to do and what they attempted to do on some of the writs and some of the appeals, they tried to go back and attack the two prior murder cases that he was in prison on. They didn't do much trying to attack the murder case here. And here was the problem he had with the current murder case when he killed his roommate or cellmate. He apparently initially lied when he talked to Internal Affairs. So when he testified, that always hurts somebody when they've told different stories and they get caught in a lie. Mm-hmm. And so what happened when he testified at trial, they were able to prove he didn't tell the truth to the initial investigating officers at Internal Affairs, and that always hurts. So they didn't really attack the current case that he went up on, the murder case of his cellmate.
They spent their energy on the prior case.
They went back and spent their energy on saying that this was ex post facto legislation when it got shot down. And the next thing they went back and attacked on the direct appeal, they tried to attack the fact that his confessions that he made in the prior murder cases were coerced, and they were coerced out of him. They were forced confessions. Those arguments rarely ever win, because what happens, I remember helping a lawyer with a case in Conroe, which a guy went into jail on Monday night, on Friday night, in perfect condition, and on Sunday morning they had two written confessions. He had loose teeth, broke up, busted lips, perforated eardrum, and had been beat on the back with a serrated towel.
In Montgomery County?
In Montgomery County.
Oh.
And they had a doctor examine him.
Not Conroe, a Conroe.
In Conroe. It's behind the Piney Wood Curtain. And so he had a doctor examine the inmate on Monday morning. And there's no question he got beat up. And when the case was tried, the deputies claimed that he might have hurt himself when he ran into the jail cell wall. Well, he had to accelerate down fast in an 8x10 cell to cause that sort of damage by banging his head on a cell wall. But they simply said what they're going to say in all those confession cases that they claim are coerced. A guy can get the hell beat out of him. You can prove he got beat up. And the guard's going to get up and say, well, he either did it to himself or his roommate did it or God did it.
Yeah.
And we didn't do it, and we promised him water, Coca-Colas and sodas and hot dogs and told him he could call his mom if he wanted to. Of course, that's all a crock.
Sure.
And they always believe the police, and the judges always believe the police. So what he did in this appeal, he went back and attacked the initial murder convictions, trying to invalidate them to knock out the capital murder charge. And I'm sure what he was attempting to do was to at least not have the capital murder charge and go ahead and get another life sentence. Why would he care? Serving two lives anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And so they attacked that. And then they did a pretty thorough job. You always have, in every capital murder case, you have the traditional thing of jurors that bounce back and forth when they grant a strike for cause, and they can't make up their mind whether they can do the death penalty or not. And they wrote a pretty thorough brief about the jury selection process, none of which worked. And then they had traditional things in the direct appeal about the statute and constitutional things that you always read. And the focus of their attention has always been two things: that it was ex post facto legislation and the prior murder convictions were not valid because the confessions were coerced, and they tried to attack the initial murder cases.
Now, this case actually happened in a Texas prison over in
Beeville.
In Beeville.
Mm-hmm.
That's B County?
B County.
I have seen trials in Walker County where they actually held the trial inside the prison.
Really? I didn't know that.
As opposed to a Wimpy Week son, Curtis Week. Houston Chronicle reporter Kathy Fair and I attended that trial, and it happened inside the compound on the Wynn unit, supposedly because Wimpy's son Curtis was so dangerous they couldn't take him to courthouse. I wonder if they made special arrangements to try this case in B County. Is there any indication?
No, there's no. They tried it at the courthouse. Apparently, that was never an issue. Apparently, they tried it at the courthouse without any particular problem. There was nothing to indicate. Because, see, in order to do what you just described, in fact, there was a case that came out this week in which they excluded a guy from voir dire examination, and he was being tried for murder in Bexar County in San Antonio. And they have to, it has to be pretty extreme to exclude somebody or to move the trial to a courthouse. They have to have a pretty ample proof of dangerousness. This particular case that just came down this week, they had a guy accused of murder, and the first thing he did on the day they're going to pick the jury, he took all of his clothes off, put it in the commode, got them soaking wet, and used it to bludgeon the guards when they came to get him out.
Dennis, what's going on?
All of the witnesses have now come back out of the prison, and they are just re-entering the administration building. And so the execution must have gone forward, and we are now, I suppose, safer.
The ritual process is over.
That's right. That process is over, and we will be back again next week.
Okay, Dennis, we appreciate your vigilance. Give our regards to the other folks there.
Will do. Thank you.
And thank you for being on standby for us.
Okay.
We know from our just conversation with Dennis Longmire that Mr. Kennedy is now dead. He will be transported to Huntsville Funeral Home, so if he has any family members, they can hightail it over there and feel the warmth of his body as it escapes rather quickly. And the whereabouts of his arrangements are unknown to us here, but as of this minute, Rogelio Reyes Kennedy, born on June the 29th, 1972, who was 19 years old when the offense occurred, is now dead. And he is survived apparently by a sister, and his former cellmate, a fellow, the 55-year-old Bonal Longoria, Lorvigido Bonal, has been dead since October the 10th, 1993. Jim, we do this all the time.
Yep, more than we want to do it.
And some of these dudes have a pretty ugly history of being pretty mean cats, and this is one of them.
Well, this is, you know, and you hate to say a typical case, but this is what you see so often in Texas death penalty cases, a kid who goes to the juvenile system. Mm-hmm. And then he goes in the juvenile system and gets out. And as soon as he gets out, he starts committing other crimes. And see, the thing is, the law, even if somebody wants to go straight, the law makes it extremely difficult to go straight. Because if you got any sort of criminal record, regardless of what they say about being able to hide it, people can find out about it. You know that as well as I do. And you're not going to get hired. In fact, I was and spent the weekend talking to a guy who was in prison down in Mexico. I mean, he wasn't in prison in Mexico. He's in Mexico, but he'd been in prison in Texas. And he'd worked real hard when he was in prison, getting a degree in business and all of that stuff. It didn't do him a nickel's worth of good. Because when he got out and tried to apply for any type of job in an office, he had all the qualifications. As soon as they found out he was an ex-convict, you weren't going to get hired.
Sure.
He'd have been better off learning to be a welder or a plumber, because at least you can get a job doing that. But getting a college degree was a waste of time.
Yeah, I know. I lecture Sam Houston criminal justice and psychology departments with John Endo, and John Endo has advanced degrees in psychology. He actually is able to work as a therapist, but his choices of where to work are very narrow, and he works with mostly juvenile offenders. They will give him a job there because certainly he speaks their language and goes through that. Nevertheless, we encourage people in prison to get all the education they can, but there is the handicap that I don't care how much education you've got, nothing's going to override that number unless you find somebody willing to go out on a limb for it.
And then what's even crazier, in many instances where there's federal funds helping public housing, mm-hmm. They won't let somebody stay there if they've been convicted. So a lot of these people that come from projects and from areas that have public assistance and federal government helps pay the housing, when they got out of prison, they can't go to visit their mother and father. They're homeless.
Yeah.
When they get out of prison, they can't get a job. And they haven't got a place to stay because their parents stay in some facility that has public assistance for housing. They can't stay there because then their parents get evicted or their mother gets evicted who happens to live there. They have no place to go.
Well, yeah, there was this interesting thing in Florida. We were talking about Florida earlier.
Right.
In Florida, they have all these rigorous restraints on registered sex offenders and where they can live and all of that. And so a bunch of them just got a bunch of clapped out old cars and vacation trailers and other kinds of shacks and just camped out under this overpass because there was literally no place else for them to
live.
And the overpass was convenient because their registration office is right across the street from where they were camped out. And now we're going to shift gears a little bit. We have got Joe.
Yes, this is Ray.
Yes, Joe Krause, who is down in Brownsville.
Yes.
I am sorry to report, Joe, that we have heard from Dennis Longmire and the ritual process is over. Mr. Kennedy is dead.
I'm sure that is the truth, unfortunately.
Could you tell us what's going on in Brownsville?
Okay, we are a very small group. We're made up of members of an organization known as Pax Christi, which is a peace action, social action group, and also the United Methodist Church, which we kind of overlap in our Pax Christi meetings. And every time there is an execution, we have a vigil from 5 until 6 at a very busy intersection in the city of Brownsville.
And you display signs and anticipate reaction from the passersby. What's that like?
We have have some reaction. Some honked their horns. One lady stopped today and was well informed. She thought that the execution was on appeal. And I told her that the Supreme Court, I believe it was on Monday, had said no. And so she was kind of surprised. She had not heard that the Supreme Court had refused any stay or anything. And we had Channel 23, which is NBC, stop today. I spoke with the young man, and I presume they'll have something on the news tonight at 10 o'clock. But I did not understand when he told me who it was that informed him, so I don't know just exactly how he got the information that we were there. But we're there regularly every time there is an execution.
Mr. Kennedy's original crimes were committed in Harlingen. So that's not far from where you are.
That's 25 miles. I wasn't aware of that.
That was Refario.
In where?
Refario.
La Feria. Oh, in La Feria. Okay. Yeah. That's a small town, probably about 40 miles from Brownsville.
Okay. So that's where it was. I guess they were tried in Harlingen. Cameron County, and that's...
Now, he was on bond for a robbery out of Harlingen when he committed the murders in
La Feria. And that was about 16 years ago, was it? Yes, it was.
Those were his original crimes, and he was being executed for a subsequent crime that happened in prison.
Oh, I see.
And he is the first person to be executed under that expansion of the Death Penalty Act. Having to do with someone who is serving a 3G sentence in prison who commits another fatal crime.
Well, the three strikes and out deal?
It's kind of like that, but it's a little higher market than that, Joe. It's he was serving time on a 3G offense, which meant that he had 99 years or life.
I see.
And while in prison, he killed someone in prison. And that was a subsequent qualification for execution.
Oh, I see. Down here, they call it capital murder plus.
Capital murder plus.
That's the way the lawyers refer to it. I have the distinct advantage, I guess, wonderful opportunity to work with two lawyers as part of their mitigation team for about 7 capital murder cases that either have been completed or are in process. And it's been just an unbelievable learning experience. And they refer to it as capital plus or capital murder plus.
Well, Joe, we're going to wander on. We've got other guests to have on, but we're sorry to bring you the sad news and give our regards to the other vigilants there in Brownsville.
Yes, and we always end our vigils with prayer for the person executed.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much for calling.
Bye-bye. That was Joe Kraus, and he's apparently a Wesleyan or a Catholic. I perceive two possibilities for him to be. Pax Christi is a Catholic organization, and he mentioned First Methodist Church. And those, of course, would be Wesleyans, and they gather in Brownsville for these vigils after each execution. And we've got, we've got 4 bodies in this case. We've got a young teenage boy and a young teenage girl, and we've got a couple of inmates. And somehow or other, they keep telling us that we're going to increase the value of life by killing people, and I'm not entirely sure that's a valid thesis. But we certainly increase the body count.
That's like curing malaria but giving more mosquitoes. That says absurd.
Apparently, according to the records before you, all of the lawyers performed admirably in this case?
There wasn't anything I could find by way of claiming any lawyer was ineffective. Because in this particular case, another thing I forgot to mention when I was talking about the case, one thing that hurt him a lot is that his story to internal affairs changed after he talked to a lawyer. And one of the things he brought up on appeal is that they accused the lawyer and Kennedy, when he testified, of committing perjury and the lawyer subordinating perjury and faking a story to try to sell to the jury.
Mm-hmm.
And they claimed that his story about what happened in the killing changed after he talked to a lawyer. And that's one of the issues brought up on appeal. But there never was an issue brought up on appeal I could find that claimed the lawyers were ineffective. The direct appeal was very thorough. And whoever did it a thorough job. And there was no hint, at least in the direct appeal to state court, that the trial lawyer was ineffective in this case.
Okay, we've got another guest. This time it's Chris Castillo. Chris, are you there?
Yes, sir, I am.
Okay, and where are you, Chris?
I'm in Beaumont, Texas.
You're in Beaumont, Texas, and you're an active member of Murder Victims Families for Reconciliation.
That's correct. I'm the National and Texas Coordinator for Murder Victims Families for Reconciliation.
Mercy, I know some of your members. We've had them on the prison show for some time. In cases of execution, what is pretty consistently your position?
Well, according to our organization, we're against the death penalty in all cases. We feel like that the money can be better spent in other ways, that it could be used to assist victims and crime victims, and the $2.3 million that it costs to put on a death penalty case is just an unreal amount of money.
You have membership everywhere. Matter of fact, close to us here is Linda White, who lives up in Montgomery County, or up in the Woodland somewhere. And she's a real regular sweetheart. And the case involving her daughter was so tragic and so ugly that I always point to people who criticize me for my position against executions by saying, well, it never happened to you. And I said, well, as a matter of fact, it has. I have two former companions that were murdered, and it happened to Linda White. And when I get through telling those stories, they're somewhat amazed that we are not revenge seekers.
Well, my mother also was murdered, and I feel the same way. I think she would want me to go on. I think that she would want me to follow in my belief. And another thing that the death penalty does is it creates another family of victims. It creates victims out of the family of individuals who are the executed family members. So the cycle of violence doesn't end, and I think that when you start talking about vengeance and closure, I don't think that real closure occurs for most people when an execution occurs.
I don't know. I don't know if there is such an animal as closure. I still miss the people that I have lost to violence. That's not going to go away. I don't think that had anything to do with what happened to the perpetrators of that violence. It's just that a loss is a loss, and though you carry it with you, your life has to go on, obviously.
And my mother was killed November 20th in 91, and I still cope with that every day. And she was strangled to death in Houston, and her murderers fled the country, and so her case remains unsolved. And so I guess in another way, I feel like we could use that money that we spend on the death penalty, and we could use that money to solve cold cases like my mother's case, or we can use that money to help crime victims who, you know, need bereavement therapy or need to pay for funeral expenses or other things. And there's a lot of things that money could be used for in a lot of different cases.
Chris, the unique thing about this case, and I know that you didn't want to get into this case, but the victim in this case, the person that was murdered by the person that was executed, was himself a murderer and in prison. And so it looks to me like all we're doing with another execution is increasing the body count.
Well, I was talking to my deacon just recently, And he said, well, do you know what they put on the cause of death after they execute someone? And I said, no, I don't know. And he says, they put homicide.
That's true.
And that was something I was not aware of.
Yeah, it just perpetuates the theory that all we're doing is expanding and generating some extra energy to the cycle.
Well, we're definitely creating more pain, you know, within the system. And there's a, you know, everyone has family members, and everyone has, you know, loved ones, you know, whether it be an Oklahoma City bombing case, you know, the father of
one of the victims is an active member.
Killer, you know, he didn't raise his son to do that.
And I just spent one day last week with the brother of Carla Faye Tucker's victim, who's very active in the organization and in carrying ministry into prison to give others encouragement and enlightenment.
Yeah, I worked in prison ministry for about 10 years, and I'm still doing it now. And it's one of the things that has brought me a lot of peace, and really has shown me that, you know, everybody is an individual, and you know, I feel, you know, as myself, I feel like everybody has a right to live.
Chris, how do people find out more about your organization?
Well, they can call me directly at 409-201-7106, or they can look us up online at mvfr.org.
mvfr.org.
Yeah, and that's Murder Victims Families for Reconciliation.
Well, thank you for being with us on Execution Watch tonight, and maybe I'll run into your prison. I go in there, do recovery. I'm generally not in on chaplaincy program, but I'm in on recovery and veterans programs all the time.
Well, we have plenty. Unfortunately, we have plenty of prisons in Texas.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Okay.
And that was Chris Castillo in Beaumont, Texas. Beautiful little historical Jefferson or one of those counties over there. And he is Murder Victims Families for Reconciliation, thus the MVFR.org acronym. Jim's back to us.
Well, you know, I was thinking when he was talking, and I've often asked people this because you get involved in a lot of discussions. If you reared a child and you had to make a choice, which would you prefer, to rear a child who was murdered or to rear a child who committed the murder? And I've often asked people that, which they had to choose, which would they choose? And they keep forgetting that people that rear children who end up committing murder probably suffer more than the people who actually had their kiddos murdered, because then they not only have the loss, they have the horrible guilt that there's something that they have done. Because they had that dual whammy. I know I was involved in defending David Brooks on the mass murder case. Sure. And as you well know, he and Elmer Wayne Henley and a guy named Dean Corll killed about every teenage kid in about a 10-block area of the Heights. And Alton Brooks, who was David's father, would come to trial every day, and he knew so many of the victims' family had all lived in the same neighborhood. And Alvin suffered terribly about that because he had not only the guilt of the fact that he was losing a son, but he also had the horrible guilt that maybe there was something that he did in rearing the kid that caused this. And he ended up dying of cancer, which oftentimes stress will often kick cancer off. And after that experience, I've asked people, I said, you know, you had to make that choice. Would you want to be the father of a murderer or the father of somebody who was killed? And I think the parent of the child who commits the murder is one that probably suffers the most, because only they lose somebody, they have that, like I say, the guilt that Alton had, and that something you never, ever get over. And you're right about the closure, because the truth of the matter is when somebody dies, a part of you dies, because
sure,
they're a part of your life.
Sure. Frankie, my mother, did not die as a result of any violence. But there's no closure there.
Sure. That's a joke to say there's no such thing as closure.
I don't know what that means, but it's certainly a phrase that Some prosecutors like to use a lot.
Or psychologists, those wackos.
Have you figured out how those people actually earn the money they get?
The study of the id by the odd. That's what it amounts to. In fact, they had a convention of psychiatrists at the Astrodome years ago, and there were some bats in there, and they were there for 3 days. Where one psychiatrist went to the other, he saw bats. So, you know, that's the kind of wackos you get.
Analyze this.
That's right. So... and that's why they come with that weird stuff like closure and seeking justice. That's a crock. Justice means what Richard Pryor and Red Fox, justice means just us blacks ain't the ones down here. That's what just us means. And that's a crock, this idea of justice and this idea of closure and this idea of seeking justice. You don't feel any better because somebody else dies because your child died. You don't feel any better. It doesn't change anything.
The Supreme Court has been busy this week.
Yes.
And one of the things that they did was they said, which harkened me to one of your favorite statements, that life without parole is just a death sentence.
That's exactly what it is.
On the slow delivery plan. They said that if you cannot sentence adolescents to life without parole.
On an homicide case.
You can only do that on a homicide case.
They didn't say that. They just said you can't do it in an homicide case. They haven't decided whether you can do it. You cannot give the death penalty for somebody on a juvenile under 17. Yeah. And see, if I told my class today, I said, for years and years, everybody's loved the state of Mississippi because it was always the bottom rung of everything. Sure. As long as you're in Mississippi, you weren't the worst state in illiteracy. You weren't the worst state in teenage pregnancies. Well, Florida can fix, Texas can thank God because Florida is worse than we are. Because they had a case where a juvenile who committed armed burglary and one other crime, got a life sentence, a juvenile. And then they abolished the parole system, which meant he would die in prison unless he got clemency on a kid. I mean, that is absurd. And that was the case that went up to the Supreme Court. And I'm shocked, of course, Scalia, Alito, and that idiot Clarence Thomas dissented in it. Roberts did a concurring opinion, because what the opinion is, a sweeping opinion, what it basically says is you cannot, if you give life without parole, you give life to a juvenile for a non-homicide felony, that violates the Eighth Amendment's cruel and unusual punishment provision. And what Roberts wanted to do is do it on a case-by-case basis. He agreed on this case it was cruel and unusual punishment. But what he said, there may be instances, for example, in a real bad rape where a woman is seriously injured and recovers, that you could give a kid life. But they didn't say you couldn't give them 60 years or 75 years.
No.
That's what they didn't say. But at least they said in this particular case it violated the Eighth Amendment's cruel and unusual prohibition against cruel and unusual punishment.
Well, our erstwhile producer has supplied me with some graphs and charts and interesting things.
That's always great.
She always does that. And
who makes those?
Here is a graph on the number of executions. Since 1976, there has been a total of 1,203 executions. For instance, the high point of the whole thing was in 1999, where 98 people were executed nationwide that year. Last year, 2009, 52 people were executed. So far this year, we have 15, but I presume we mean 16 as of today. Interesting, just looking at these figures, there was... criminologists' view of deterrence. You ask criminologists, do executions lower homicide rates? 88% of them say no, 5% of them say yes, 7% of them said I don't care, which I don't know where to put them in that column. But exonerations, for instance. An interesting thing about exonerations. Florida has had 23 exonerations from death row. I presume that means that the people were innocent, the cases were, or the trials were so bad that there's no way to determine.
Probably DNA stuff is probably my guess.
Illinois has had 20. Texas has had 11. And I suspect almost all of those came out of Dallas where they actually preserved the evidence. Death row inmates by state. Actually, California has more death row inmates than any other state, 694. But they're not killing any people, so it kind of backs up. It's kind of like bad plumbing. It backs up, so you get a lot of it. On death row, 43% or 42% of the people on death row are black. 44% are white. Hispanic are 12%. And other races are 2%. That's a phenomenal figure whenever you look at population figures. Actually, Hispanics are amazingly better behaved than the rest of us, or there'd be more of them on death row, I presume. Is there any use to gathering all these statistics, Jim?
Sure. Gives us something to do. We have radio time to kill. It gives us one thing.
Yeah, that's one thing.
And gives people make pie charts. Sure, there's something good about that. Because what happens, for example, if it wasn't for one of the things that Justice Kennedy relied upon when he wrote the opinion about juveniles, was the fact that we're the only nation anywhere on the planet, in the world, that gives life sentences to juveniles. And that came as a result of statistics, because European, even Russia and China doesn't do that. And so the only way he would know that is through statistics. Sure, there's some usefulness to it.
Well, do you actually think that, obviously we've got a crime problem, and obviously we've got an incarceration problem, and obviously we've got an execution problem. Is there any foreseeable solution to these problems?
Well, I'll tell you how you can solve it is do the Dave Garner approach, make everything legal and you wouldn't have crime. The thing is, we've got too many things. In fact, part of the El Paso City Council met with some people and had a press conference about legalizing marijuana. Because
yeah.
We have got some real stupid laws. And I probably am going to be sexist when I sound this. I call this the feminization of criminal law. It used to be you would get in a fist fight and you went home and everybody was happy. Now you get in a fist fight, everybody goes to jail and everybody gets charged with assault and you clog up the system. And that's because you can't use fighting words anymore. We've had a lot of stupid stuff, and the drug laws are absurd. If we just legalized marijuana and let those people out, we would clean out a lot of prisons. And it's absolutely absurd that we've locked up people that simply use drugs.
Well, how are you going to drive the price of it up if you don't criminalize it?
Well, here's what's even crazier, Ray. The people that sentence folks to jail for using drugs, half of them were on prescription drugs.
Listen. There was one judge who used to be a programmer at this radio station, and I had to come in pretty regular and confiscate his green leafy stuff. And then he became a county judge, and he is hell on wheels on people.
Well,
I don't. I'm not entirely sure that he stopped smoking.
But don't forget, remember the preacher that just got back into Miami, Florida, with the boy companion that had written the book straight, and he was that real advocate.
Yeah, you know, it was so straight, and nobody noticed the prematurely orange hair.
And what was even funnier, Ray, he was charging, he was going on testifying in all these cases about not letting gay people adopt families.
Yeah.
He was clipping states for about $100,000.
$300,000 quick.
And then he hires a rent-a-boy and goes to Europe.
Can afford one.
Here's what he said. I thought it was funny. He said, well, I had surgery, then rent boy had to carry, I had hired him to carry my luggage. Well, they had a photograph of him pushing his own baggage cart and carrying his boy's luggage.
Well, his pretty boy was standing there, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, right. But you know, I don't think, there's nothing you can do about hypocrisy. And if we made political prostitution as illegal as we make sexual prostitution, most government meetings would happen inside jail somewhere.
Yeah. But I think one of the things we've got to do, we've got to just lax up and quit being so harsh on punishment, and we've got to lax up and start making things, not saying anything's illegal. Hell, at one time, ever spice that we had was held illegal at one time or another. Mm-hmm. And it's just absolutely absurd that marijuana, having a marijuana laws, put people in jail. We just had a deal here in Houston in which three people are dead because of a marijuana deal. Some kids came in. This happened last night or night before last. Yeah. They came in with a load of marijuana, and some guys in the parking lot met them at the apartment and shot and killed three people over marijuana.
Over green leafy stuff.
Over stuff that grows naturally. And that is just absolutely absurd. And the reason we have so much violence in Mexico, one of the reasons is because marijuana is illegal. If we would legalize it, that would solve a lot of problems.
Well, Jim, on several occasions you have talked about the process of the escalation of dangerousness by going into the juvenile system for criminal activity. And tonight's example, Mr. Kennedy.
Yes.
Had been in trouble since he was 10 years old. What did they do about it? They sent him to a youth home or
institution
or KYC and TYC, Texas Youth Commission.
Texas Youth Commission.
And that, what? That introduced him to other young ruffians?
Yeah, and to being mistreated by guards. Because one thing you're going to notice in this case, usually when you have a beating where you tie somebody up and stomp them, you're dealing with somebody who has a lot of pent-up anger. And that pent-up anger had to come from some of the jail officials. He spent most of his life in jail or locked up. From the age of 10, he'd been in the juvenile correction facilities. Gets out, he's been a product of our juvenile system and of our criminal system, and all that anger came from somewhere. And so when you start stomping somebody like that and doing what he did, that indicates he was horribly angry about something. And where did that come from? It came from the way he was treated when he was 10 years old and up. And like you say, he's probably not the brightest bulb in the drawer. And when you get somebody that's a little bit dumb and you mistreat them, you've got trouble on your hands. If I have a dog, for example, that bites people, I take it to the vet and the dog beats the vet beats the dog, am I going to be shocked if the dog bites me and bites other people? Of course not. It's just stupid. And so we really create a lot of these people by our systems.
Well, you know, I know from my own prison experience, the way I describe prison experience is about 98% really boring. And maybe about 1.8% something interesting going on. And 0.2% terror. I mean terror. The fear. The fear of the immense power the authorities have over you. The fear over people in an unstable mental condition in your immediate surround. There's an enormous amount of stress in prison culture. And I only spent 4 years of now a 70-year-old life there. I have no concept of what it would be like for Mr. Kennedy to have spent almost all of his short life in some kind of an institution. And I can see where that breeds the kind of behavior, unpredictable and granted horrible behavior, that he assumed for whatever reason. And I still don't know what happened that night in that cell, and I don't know who contributed to making that environment unsafe for Mr. Kennedy or his victims. This is Ray Hill. You're listening to Execution Watch on KPFT Houston HD2 channel. I want to thank Jim Skelton for his participation in the show. It's always good to have Jim around to talk to. We don't, I think, enjoy this work, but we enjoy one another's company while we are doing it. This is only possible because we have the expertise of Elizabeth Stein, who is our executive producer. Our technical director and wizard is Otis McClay. Theme music at the beginning and maybe here at the end is by Victoria Panetti. My name is Ray Hill. Thank you for listening.